Rewind, your week in review is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.
This week on Rewind, your week in review, Governor Tony Evers reached a deal with the federal government to maintain around $70 million in monthly food aid for low-income families.
We're really hopeful that it will be a fairly short pause.
Wisconsin health officials have suspended the use of the Johnson & Johnson COVID-19 vaccine over concerns about rare reports of blood clots. And the Wisconsin Supreme Court heard oral arguments in two cases that could have big implications for state environmental regulations. Rewind, your week in review for April 16th.
I'm Brianna Riley.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
This week, Republican lawmakers directed the state's Democratic Attorney General to join a multi-state lawsuit challenging a COVID policy. The GOP-led Assembly and Senate okayed a resolution ordering AG Josh Call to join a lawsuit targeting a federal provision that prevents states from using COVID relief dollars from the federal American Rescue Plan Act for tax relief. The DOJ has no plans to join that lawsuit. A spokeswoman said the legislature can authorize that request that the agency join, but it cannot compel DOJ to do so. Lawmakers also signed off during their floor sessions this week on a slate of 11 bills to spend much of the $3.2 billion that Wisconsin is getting under ARPA. Governor Evers has signaled he will veto them. The GOP framework also includes a $1 billion property tax cut. That's a one-time 10% rebate on 2020 property taxes. But as mentioned before, it could violate the federal policy. JR, what is the purpose of directing Call to do this when the legislature doesn't appear to have the authority to do so? And also, Call wouldn't necessarily be the best advocate for this position for the state.
Oh, it's messaging and it's trying to put a squeeze on Josh Call. It's the same thing with the 11 bills Republicans passed directing how the COVID money should be used. It's all about messaging, putting down a marker. So here with the AG resolution, they're arguing that the state law says he should end up being a party. I'm not a lawyer. I don't play one on TV, as I've said before, but I did call several this week and ask them, like, look, can they compel him to do this? And their answer was no. And that's from people who worked at DOJ from both sides of the aisle. So it's more about trying to send a message to the voters that here's Josh Call, who, by the way, will be up for election in 2022, isn't willing to fight for your tax cut, right? So it's a little bit of a messaging thing. Likewise with the bills. We know they're going to get vetoed. It frustrates some of Robin Voss and Devin LeMahieu, who said earlier, to no end that they don't have any power or any say-so in how these things are spent. They're putting down a marker of, if we had our druthers, this is how we'd spend it. Now, the rush to put that message down, though, is causing some issues because, as we know from the Fiscal Bureau memos, which is the nonpartisan budget arm of the legislature, some of these bills right now violate the provisions in the federal package. So you can't pay down debt with that money. You can't use it to create new road grants for local governments. Now, maybe if the guidance changes, you could, but it's more message, it's more theater than it is about actually getting something in law to dictate how this money is spent.
Messaging has really been the theme of the floor sessions this week, and maybe some could argue the session as a whole thus far, right? I mean, we saw the Senate this week pass four election bills, I believe, that would target, you know, voting practices in the state. Those are all, and the 10 other bills or so that are headed towards Governor Evers in the coming weeks and months are, you know, basically going to be vetoed. We also saw the Assembly pass a sales tax holiday, largely along party lines, though there was some bipartisan support for it, that would allow bars and restaurants to basically nix rate the sales tax between June and the end of August. That doesn't have a Senate sponsor, right? So a lot of these bills are about getting the priorities out there, getting the messaging out there. I think the one thing, you know, we've talked a lot about the 11 COVID bills that are on their way to Governor Evers right now. One thing we haven't really talked about is what next steps look like, right? You know, there was this talk about on the Assembly floor from Speaker Voss about a potential lawsuit. There's maybe a discussion about putting these in the budget, though I don't necessarily think that makes sense because it gives Governor Evers more, you know, more potential language to use his partial veto authority over. Is this a hill that Republicans will seek to, I guess, die on in the coming weeks and months? Or, you know, has now that the messaging has sort of passed, they were able to get these bills through, are we going to move on from this, do you think?
Well, the budget, my impression is that they're looking for ways to account for the federal money in the budget. And you've heard them talk about this, that they think they should know what governors want to do with everything while they craft that thing. Now, the governor's giving more of an overview than he has, like every single cent, where it would go. Because he's got, I think, 3 or 4 years to spend the money, something like that. He's got some time to dole this out. It would actually go beyond his first term. But Republicans are arguing that, look, you know, look at schools. With all this federal money coming in, they want to account for that and how the budget is put together. They want to know what's, where a government is going to send this stuff to account for it and how they do broadband, for example. They called for in the bill $500 million. Governor Evers wants $200 million of state money in the budget, plus more money from the COVID COVID package to bolster that. I kind of wait to see what Republicans do with this money when it comes to writing the budget. Now, the election bills that you mentioned, you know, I get the impression there's a little bit of a different message with those because that's a political base issue. The base of the Republican Party right now does not trust, well, at least a segment of it, doesn't trust elections. There are a lot of conspiracy theories that are going around that, you know, Dominion flips votes away from Republicans. What's the point of going to vote anyway? Republicans have to do something in their minds to assure their base that they are fighting for them and to try and make the elections, quote unquote, fair, because their worry is, even if it's a point or two off the GOP base, if those guys say it's not worth turning out anymore because it's all rigged, if they lose them in a purple state, that's a big deal. So there's a little bit there more at stake from politically than it is about messaging on financially with these COVID bills.
That's a fair point. And also with the election bills, I think I'm still looking, and I don't know if you feel the same way, JR, to see what the broader, I guess, intent, right, of both the Assembly and Senate Republican caucuses are with this. I mean, we, in the Assembly at least, the Elections Committee is still holding, or hasn't held really any investigative quote-unquote hearings in recent weeks, but they also haven't held any public hearings yet on these bills, especially as they're, you know, clearing the Senate in groups. We still have to wait for the Assembly Elections Committee to take those up while they're also holding this parallel process where they're looking into the use of election grant funding in these, you know, in particularly these five Democratic cities, the state's biggest cities. Do you see, I guess, a broader theme working its way through with all this?
I think there's a dual track of what's going on. One, there are these bills being pushed now. Two, there's the audit that probably won't be done by the Legislative Audit Bureau, which is a nonpartisan arm of the legislature. Won't be done until probably fallish. So you might see some bills move now through both houses, then get vetoed by the governor, and then have them come back in the fall and see what the Audit Bureau says to kind of bolster the case for these bills. Now, if I've talked to people across both aisles over recent weeks, I mean, there's some real legitimate questions to be talked about and how we run elections in Wisconsin. Should there be a statewide standard for issues X, Y, and Z? If we had rational people having those conversations, they could probably come to a conclusion and maybe set down something that was a agreeable statewide standard in some things. However, we don't have like really a rational conversation going on. We have partisans who are entrenched right now, Republicans who want to placate a base unhappy about what happened in November 2020, Democrats were suspicious of anything to change anything about how the election was run because they feel like the allegations are baseless that Republicans are raising, and so we're at a standoff. And what you're really maybe seeing is a message from Republicans of if they win the governor's office in 2022 and maintain both houses of legislature, this is what they would do if, you know, the issue is still alive come January 2023 when it comes to election laws in Wisconsin.
All right, now let's hear from Representative Jody Emerson and Tyler August about the original topic we were discussing, the resolution surrounding Attorney General Josh Call.
I'm also confused because while the majority party seems to profess being behind local control, they've repeatedly done so many things to take away local control, including some things that we've done here today. Then there's the whole idea of federal dollars that we've been dealing with today. And if we really want to deal with federal dollars, perhaps the majority party might want to think about accepting the Medicaid expansion, which would bring in $1 billion over the next 2 years alone. But yet you want to pass this resolution so you can do whatever you want to with federal money. So if you want the flexibility with federal money, expand Medicaid. Then you can have that money to play with. But stop pretending that you hold other jobs. You're not the governor. You're not the attorney general. We have separation of powers. Let the executive branch do their job, and we should all concentrate on our job.
It seems that the only power that the Democrats are interested in separating is the legislative power from any decision-making in the state. This resolution comes because the Speaker and the Senate Majority Leader sent a letter to the Attorney General and asked him, on the behalf of the people of this state, to enter the lawsuit that a bunch of attorneys general around the country have started against the federal government, saying, you know what, federal government, you don't have the right to tell us we can't cut taxes for 4 years. If people vote against this resolution, they are in essence saying that they think it's okay for the federal government to tell states how to run their budgets and how to tax their citizens.
Governor Tony Evers this week reached a deal to maintain $70 million in monthly federal food aid. The low-income Wisconsinites now will still continue to get assistance after Evers and the U.S. Department of Agriculture announced an agreement this week. Wisconsin secured the dollars by issuing an emergency declaration directing DHS to, quote, continue taking all actions necessary to address the COVID-19 pandemic. The money was in jeopardy for May after the Wisconsin Supreme Court overturned Evers' emergency public health declaration and mask mandate. Prior to the announcement, Speaker Voss suggested lawmakers should override a previously vetoed COVID bill to restore the dollars. That bill contained a provision that would have given Evers the authority to issue orders for the sake of securing federal dollars. But overriding a veto, right, would require two-thirds support in both chambers, and with Democrats to come along, not necessarily a real option that lawmakers would have been able to consider. Just last week, though, it did look like this funding wouldn't be preserved for May, given the timing of the court's order and the lack of legislative appetite to pass a clean bill on this. JR, how did we get to this point?
Well, give credit to the Evers administration. So the legislative fix was not a likely solution to this. And look, Republicans, when you've asked them, like, well, why aren't you guys going to do a clean bill to make sure we qualify for this money? They'll say, look, they had the shot. AB1, which is the bill that Governor Evers vetoed, included a provision to allow him to declare an emergency to qualify for the money. It also, though, included a bunch of COVID provisions that Republicans wanted and Dems did not like. So that was not going to happen. So their answer was basically, hey, he had his shot. Now it's his problem. If he wants to fix it, have Democrats override the veto or pass that bill again. You know, we're more than happy to do that. So what Evers did was his administration actually, you look through like the announcement, they began working with the federal government even before the Supreme Court ruling to find a way to kind of create a longer period to secure funding, a two-month approval to kind of as a bridge. And then they were prepared for that decision to come down against them to kind of figure out what's an alternative. So not long after the decision came down, about a week later, a week and a day, I think, something like that, DHS Secretary Karen Timlake signed this declaration, which really amounts to saying, keep doing what you're doing, guys. We're doing, you know, it wasn't really much of a declaration, but it was enough to qualify for this new definition from the feds to get the money. Now, interesting to note that state of Michigan, I believe, did something similar with the federal government to qualify for the money there. So there were signs that this could happen. And it's also a sign of a new approach from the Biden administration versus what the Trump administration has been doing when it comes to these things. Remember, a year ago, there was a federal government program that if you did not have a one-week delay in collecting unemployment benefits, you got federal matching money to cover that first week of benefits. The legislature waited a few weeks to pass the bill that included that suspension. There was a period we could have gotten the federal matching money. We did not. They asked about getting it done retroactively. The Fed said no. Now, fast forward to this year, similar thing happened where that suspension expired, but DWD now said, the Workforce Development Agency said, hey, we're asking the feds for that money retroactively, and they're going to work with us. They want to help us. This is the Biden administration saying, we want to find ways to get you this money to do this stuff. It's also an example of where Assembly Speaker Robin Voss is trying to find ways to engage Governor Evers and give some kind of give and take, and Evers continues to go around the speaker to try and find ways to do what he wants to do without getting that interaction with the legislature.
Mm-hmm. Yep, and also it's worth noting that this money was first made available under the federal coronavirus, the Families First Coronavirus Response Act, and I believe that it only is available under that law through the end of June. So this move has secured funding for low-income families for the next 2 months then. Let's move on now to the COVID update this week. Wisconsin health officials have paused the use of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine in an announcement on Tuesday. The decision follows a federal recommendation to pause the rollout as officials review blood clot cases among individuals who received the J&J shot. Only 7 million individuals who got the vaccine in the U.S. reported the blood clots. The J&J vaccine accounts for 4% of the shots so far in the state. None of the cases so far that have been identified have occurred in Wisconsin. Let's hear more on this from DHS Deputy Secretary Julie Willems-Van Dyke.
So I want to be really clear. This is a pause, not the end of J&J. And we're really hopeful that it will be a fairly short pause to do what I just described, to further ascertain if there are any more of these events, and then to prepare our healthcare providers for treating them if they occur. So we're very hopeful that this will be a fairly short pause, and we'll be back administering J&J very shortly. But even if we can't, the progress that we've just described in terms of moving vaccine forward has been largely at the hands of administering Pfizer and Moderna vaccine. 96% of the vaccines given in Wisconsin have been Pfizer or Moderna doses. We've already ascertained that this risk of this rare event is about 1 in 1 million for this vaccine. The risk of getting COVID in the United States is 1 in 10. The risk of dying from COVID is 1 in 600 in the United States. As each of us thinks about this and weighs those risks, I think it's really important to look at that whole picture and think both, what is my risk of not getting this? What is my risk if I get COVID? Who else I might infect? What family member I might infect that could cause them to have harm? What coworker might I infect? And then what are the real facts around those vaccines? And each person has to make that decision for themselves.
In other COVID news this week, the Wisconsin Supreme Court ruled 4-3 that Evers can't limit capacity at bars and restaurants to curb the spread of COVID-19 without legislative approval. The underlying order issued last fall limited public gatherings amid worsening COVID case counts. The move was quickly blocked in the courts before it expired November 6th. And in the decision this week, it basically states that the DHS and the Evers administration should have gone through the rulemaking process. Chief Justice Pat Rogensack, writing for the conservative majority, said, quote, "It is important to confirm once again that Emergency Order 3 is beyond the power that the legislature delegated to the secretary designee. The liberal minority, led by Justice Ann Walsh Bradley, wrote in their dissent, quote, "At a time when public health experts are imploring pandemic-weary Wisconsinites to stay vigilant, a faulty statutory analysis once again leads this court to undermine public health measures." It's worth noting that conservative Justice Brian Hagedorn wrote a concurring opinion with the majority after siding with liberals last May against striking down Evers' extended safer at home order. So following the safer at home order, the Supreme Court ruling, also the Supreme Court ruling on the mask mandate and underlying public health emergency declaration, this is the third time the court has ruled against COVID restrictions that the Evers administration has imposed. Any surprises from this ruling, JR?
No, it was kind of expected. Also, it's kind of a moot point if you think about it, because the original order from then DHS Secretary Karen Timberlake expired November 6th. It was placed on hold in the middle of the order by the Third District Court of Appeals up in Wausau, so it wasn't really enforced that much. Basically, the court is saying, no, we really meant it. Like when we said back last year that it should be a rule, we really meant it, and we're reinforcing that. And even in Rogensack's ruling, she notes that there's this issue of mootness when it comes to this case. And she wrote that it was important to take it up, even though that this is kind of expired, to reinforce the limits of the powers of DHS, because it will guide future secretaries and governors on how they should operate. And basically, again, when you want to do something like this, if you're an administration, you have to go through the rules process, which gives legislative oversight. It is another kind of reining of the powers of the governor in a pandemic, which hopefully we'll never live through again, in my lifetime at least. But this is a totally unique situation, and we're going through what the limits of these powers are in the Constitution and in state law, because they envision something like this going on this long. I mean, it's been 100 years, this is the last example that we have of something like this. So it's the court saying, here's another guardrail, on how a governor should act and operate during a pandemic and the extent of his or her powers in trying to curb that pandemic.
Does this order, though, really further limit the power the Evers administration has or any future administration on this? I mean, I recall at the time the administrative rationale for going forward with this was that it relied on part of the law that the Supreme Court didn't touch in the May Safer at Home decision, which is giving DHS the power to, you know, ban public gatherings or limit public gatherings in schools and churches and other places like this. Is this just because it, you know, obviously was no surprise to many of us, is this really a further limit on those powers, or is this just a natural extension of the court's May order?
Well, I'm not a lawyer, but I've read a lot of court decisions, court briefs in the last few years of my life. And if you get down in some of the footnotes of these cases, one of the things the governor's administration had kind of hung its argument on was that there was a footnote in that May ruling about the powers when it comes to schools, okay? And it seemed like the Evers folks were trying to say, look, you didn't really address this issue back in May, so we think there's an opening here, this power now. And it seems like the court, again, not being a lawyer, so, you know, take my reading with a grain of salt, is trying to kind of say, no, we kind of addressed this before. You can't really use that school issue to get around what we're saying about the rules process when you're issuing an order like this.
Okay, let's get out of the footnotes and move on to another topic. The Wisconsin Supreme Court weighed environmental cases in oral arguments this week. Justices heard those arguments Monday in two cases brought by conservation group Clean Wisconsin, which center on factory farming regulations and high-capacity well permitting. The first challenge, filed back in 2015, is based on an expansion permit DNR awarded to Kinnard Farms in dairy farm-intensive Kewaunee County 3 years prior. The second lawsuit, filed in 2016, targets DNR's approval of 8 high-capacity well permit applications in the Central Sands region. This approval came after then-Attorney General Brad Schimmel, a Republican, altered the process for approving those wells, saying that DNR can't consider their cumulative impacts on surrounding lakes and streams. That opinion, though, it's worth noting, was withdrawn by the current Attorney General Josh Call last May. Both of these cases are connected to 2011 Act 21, which limited agencies' authority and added more steps to the rulemaking process. And also, you know, it's worth noting both of these cases are years in the making, right? And they have big potential implications for agency authority and water protections going forward. JR, any background to note in these years-long cases?
Yes, this is an intense issue in places like Kewaunee County, places like central Wisconsin, where water is becoming a very touchy subject politically, especially if you live up in the Kewaunee area, you are worried about the quality of your water right now. It has become a much hotter topic in the last decade. So this is going to be a closely watched decision for the impact in those efforts at clean water, because you're hearing more and more of a call for clean water initiatives in the Capitol. Some Republicans passed a whole clean water package last session, right? There's a reason for that, because they're hearing it from their constituents, and this case plays into that.
Republicans did, you know, pass that clean water package right in the Assembly, but they died in the Senate as, you know, we were awaiting sort of the final floor period for the regular session, which never came because of COVID in part. So there's a question, of course, of whether there's a lack of momentum, right, on these issues. So there's a question of whether that will, you know, pick back up this session, either in the budget or in separate standalone legislation. But on top of that, right, I think it's important to note that the DNR is also working through the rulemaking process on two pretty big issues, right, on the nitrate contamination front and PFAS compounds. So they're looking at cracking open NR 151 once again, the same rule that regulates farm runoff, basically, that they changed a couple of years ago to protect Kewaunee County and those 15 eastern Wisconsin counties and expand those protections statewide. That could run into some issues. We're in the economic impact portion of that rule process, and there's already been some concerns from Republican lawmakers and others about the impacts financially on farms, CAFOs, and the sort. So this could have widespread implications, and also there's a lot of other water quality issues for us to be keeping an eye on in the next few weeks and months.
Absolutely.
All right, let's move on to stocks now. What's rising this week, JR?
So rising, what do I have rising this week, Brianna?
Annette Ziegler.
Annette Ziegler, thank you. So there's a lot of stuff happening in the Capitol this week. Annette Ziegler, okay, so interesting move here by the Supreme Court. 6 years ago, voters approved the referendum that gave the court the power to select the Chief Justice rather than having that go to the most tenured member of the court. Shirley Abramson, the longtime liberal justice, had been Chief Justice for 19 years because of that tenure provision. Once it was changed, conservatives grabbed that and made Pat Rogensack the Chief Justice. Now, Pat Rogensack's term's not up for two more years, but she is stepping aside from being Chief Justice, and they picked Annette Ziegler. Now, this is kind of court insider baseball, but it's really kind of juicy stuff. The conservative coalition on the Supreme Court, which is 4-3 right now, has its fractures. If you read those footnotes, which you knocked a little earlier in what I was talking about, if you read those footnotes, there's a lot of kind of back and forth between people like Brian Hagedorn and Rebecca Bradley, taking shots at the rationale and stuff. There's tension in that kind of conservative coalition. So Rogensack, from what I was told by my sources, had kind of looked to step away from this job a couple of years ago because it's an administrative position. It's an extra, you know, burden. But looking at the justices, you probably weren't going to get Justice Bradley voting for Justice Hagedorn and vice versa. Annette is kind of like the compromise candidate for conservatives. She can lead the court. Rogensack can step back. And oh, by the way, this is a chance for Annette Ziegler to be the Chief Justice before 2023 when the control of the court will be up for grabs, because Pat Rogensack is 80 right now. She's not expected to seek re-election in 2023. So even if she did, it would be a control a vote or a fight for control of the court. But by stepping back, if she does in 2 years, there'll be an open seat. That could be the most expensive Supreme Court race we will ever see in Wisconsin. It's going to be quite interesting to cover. And this is a change for the court and the administration. It gives Annette Ziegler a chance to run the show for a couple of years.
Yep, sounds good. What's mixed this week, J.R.?
Sarah Godlewski. So we have another entrant in the race for U.S. Senate. So Godlewski, state treasurer, elected in 2018. She joins a field that includes, for example, Alex Lazary, the Bucks executive who's taken a leave of absence from his post with the team, Tom Nelson, the Allegheny County executive. There's a doctor from up north, Dr. Bettino, from the Wausau area. Isn't a very well-known candidate, but the field is growing. And whenever a field grows like this, you kind of get people talking about the lanes that candidates have. So with Nelson, you kind of got the outstate lane. He's trying to burnish his progressive credentials as a Bernie backer, that kind of thing. Lazary's got the Milwaukee kind of base in his backyard, right? Godlewski's from Eau Claire. She's kind of more of a Madison candidate, so has it more of in her backyard. So you see those lanes right now with those three as the main contenders. The big wild card is Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes. If he gets in, it changes the entire dynamic of the race because Godlewski is going to enjoy the support of Emily's List, for example, which supports female candidates that support abortion rights. That's going to be a big boost for her financially. Barnes, however, also has an attraction with national groups, would bring resources to the race. He's kind of seen as both a Milwaukee candidate where he's from and a Madison candidate where a lot of the progressive groups really are enamored with him. He would bring national attention. Ellen is also the only black candidate in the race, with a party that's becoming more and more interested in social justice issues and racial justice issues, right, at its core. So it would be a fascinating dynamic of those four. Now, we've also started to see some fundraising numbers this week in that race. Ron Johnson has yet to say whether he's going to seek a third term in 2022. His fundraising picked up in the first quarter of this year, raised about $500,000, which sounds great. But of the six senators who are considered the most vulnerable incumbents in 2022, all raised at least $1 million. So Ron Johnson still not fully turned on the fundraising machine if he wants to run again in 2022. Alex Lazary raised more than $1 million in pouring over his report. About a third of it's already come from donors who have maxed out. That means they can't go back for more contributions. So it's a good first number for him, but he can't keep tapping those donors for more money. He's got to find new ones. By the way, of those donors that maxed out, a lot of them came from out of state, especially his home state of New York. Which kind of reinforces the image of Alex Lazary as a candidate who's from New York running for a Wisconsin seat. Tom Nelson raised about $240,000, which shows he's a grinder, but it's going to be a grind to raise that money to run a statewide race like this. And Godlewski, you know, she's got personal resources, which is good for her on one hand, but they're also going to be picked over to see if she really is progressive, if she wants to portray herself on the campaign trail.
I'm glad you took the opportunity to dive into the fundraising reports. Thanks for doing that. And what's falling this week, JR?
Medical marijuana. Look, before Robin Voss kind of touched off this intrigue in the Capitol about saying that he was supportive of medical marijuana, especially an alternative to opioids, which we've had a problem with in Wisconsin for a long time. But Scott Fitzgerald, then the Senate Majority Leader, said no way on his watch. Basically, he was not in favor whatsoever. And so it was kind of this perception that, oh, it's Fitz is kind of holding, there's a roadblock for this. And that really wasn't true. Yes, Fitz is personally opposed and would never let the bill go to the floor, but his caucus wasn't there. Remember that we talked about before the kind of rule of 17? As a leader in the Senate, you want to have 17 votes on most bills from your caucus alone to pass a bill, because once you rely on the minority to pass something, you also enable the minority to demand things. So fast forward now to yesterday at our luncheon with Devin LeMahieu, who succeeded Fitzgerald in that seat. He also said he opposes medical marijuana. He said if FDA approves it, he'd be okay if there was a doctor's prescription along with it, but that should be a national discussion. He doesn't want any quote-unquote rogue states going forward. So it reinforces that, one, it wasn't just Fitz, that the caucus isn't quite there, and two, that this bill's not going anywhere with a Republican-controlled state legislature. Now, in talking to folks, I get the impression that there are some Republicans who warmed up to the idea, who are okay with it, but we're not in the neighborhood of 17 votes yet in the Republican caucus to get that bill out of the legislature and on the governor's desk.
Yep, thanks for running all of that down, JR, and thanks for tuning in. I'm Brianna Riley.
And I'm JR Ross.
And that's Rewind, your week in review for April 16th.
Rewind, your week in review, is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.